It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Curwood. If you're searching for the world's oldest and luscious rainforest, you'd likely head to the South Pacific island of Borneo, which is governed by Indonesia and Malaysia, and you might want to hurry. Widespread fires last year and the year before devastated about 12 million acres of forest and bush on Borneo, and continued logging endangers the habitat that remains. Campbell Webb is a botanist from Arnold Arboretum at Harvard University who recently traveled deep into the Indonesian side of Borneo through territory that is largely unexplored. He found a rainforest still teeming with biodiversity and a way of life under assault. His audio diary is read by Robin Lubbock.
The Bornean gibbons announce another dawn in the rainforest. The smell of wood smoke and coffee curls up to the sleeping platform of our crude shelter. I'm shivering in the cool of the morning in a remote part of the Indonesian province of West Kalimantan. I'm out here to analyze the species composition of the trees to try to understand how the rainforest works before it's gone. Borneo is in the midst of immense change. Logging, slash-and-burn agriculture, and industrial plantations are destroying the forests. With the severe monetary crisis, everyone here is scrambling for any income they can find, and often they find it in the forest. My trip to Bukit Lumut had taken 5 days from the provincial capital. The first leg of the journey featured a 12-hour bus ride along potholed roads. We arrived late at night in the town of Nanga Pino to find that the river Melawi had flooded and the streets were waist-deep in water. I had to hire a dugout canoe to reach the guest house. Next morning, before dawn, I washed in the river, ladling the cold water over me. The rivers here are the source of drinking water and food, the primary routes for travel, as well as being the bathroom and garbage disposal. From Nanga Pino, I hired a speedboat, and for 2 days we motored upriver. At the village of Gangjang, the boatman took me to the headman, and we discussed, in a roundabout fashion, how many guides I needed and what I'd have to pay them. We sat on the floor of his house eating rice and boiled fish that his son had just caught. Next morning, I set off upriver with the four men who would be my guides, co-workers and companions in the forest, Arun, Atai, Freddy and Kuhin. We crept upriver against the swift current, alternately motoring with an old two-horsepower outboard and poling along when the river became too shallow or too fast. Eventually, we left the last huts and rice fields and entered undisturbed forest, which arched over the river high above us. After 2 days, we arrived at a fork in the river. My guides told me that the boat would go no further. I checked the trees, the geology, and the topography of the land. It was perfect. The guides set to work immediately, building our sleeping hut or pondok. They combed the nearby forest for stout saplings, which they lashed together with rattan vines to form a high platform. They stretched a large blue tarpaulin I'd brought over a roof frame and wove a floor out of small sapling stems, snapping the stems and binding them with rattan. They finished as an evening thunderstorm drew close. We huddled up high over the dark forest floor and enjoyed bowls of rice and dried fish. Now it's morning and the real work begins. We hike up into the hills surrounding our camp and set up a survey plot. Freddy and Kuhin lay out the plot boundaries and measure the trees inside. Freddy calls out the diameter of each tree, then nails an aluminum tag to the trunk so that I can find the trees again and re-measure them if I ever return. They finish in a few hours and leave me alone to get on with the job of identifying the trees. Those are giant hornbills, and those are red-leafed monkeys. Nearly every tree I turn to is a different type. A single acre of forest here might contain over 100 different tree species, compared to 10 in New England. I strain to peer through my binoculars into the canopy, 120 feet above. Here, biodiversity isn't just an abstract concept, it's all around you. It's almost twilight when I get back to our camp. I take a swim in the cold, clear water and climb up to the sleeping platform. Freddy offers me a bowl of rice and fish stew, seasoned with leaves he collected from a mangus bush on the riverbank. It starts raining again. After dinner, the guides tell stories late into the evening by the sooty light of a kerosene flame. Sometimes they go hunting at night with their homemade muskets loaded with hand-mixed gunpowder. They'd come back at 3 or 4 in the morning with a deer or a porcupine, but they say hunting these days is much harder.
If this was the old days, we'd be coming back with many more animals. They used to get deer just with a spear, but we have to use guns now. The animals were tame then. They'd never met people before.
Now, you have to go far up into the hills to get them. There aren't any close to the village. You could say they have almost disappeared.
The traditional knowledge fundamental to living well in the forest is also slipping away. I couldn't find anyone who still knew how to hunt with a blowgun, and even the vital skills of choosing the right location for a rice field are being lost. Atai says chainsaws have made people more wasteful.
Long ago, before there were chainsaws, our grandparents would make planks by hand, chopping down a tree and then splitting the log with a budgie. Like this, they didn't need to cut too many trees. It didn't waste wood like a chainsaw.
After 3 weeks, I've finally completed my survey of 2 hectares of forest and collected many specimens. It's time to leave. Unfortunately, the boat that was meant to come to collect us has not arrived. Not to worry, says Arun. We'll build a raft. I watch as they fell 10 large trees, strip them of their bark, and drag the trunks to the river. Using thick rattan vines, they lash them together into 2 rafts and construct raised platforms to keep our baggage dry. Finally, they cut long steering poles. Arun says he can make almost anything out of the forest.
For example, we make small boats out of bonga wood. Lots of things in the forest are useful. We make roof tiles out of ironwood or bulu trees of resak. We can even make them out of tengkawang wood. Rattan is also important.
We pack up and set off downriver. At first, the rafts float gently down, banging softly on shallow boulders. But the rapids aren't far ahead. I hear the roar in the distance. Coming around a bend in the river, we see the granite boulders at the head of the rapids. My guides are silent, except for the sharp shouts as they line up the long rafts with the flow. In a second, we're surrounded by frothing, watery noise. Our raft is fully submerged, and I'm up to my chest, holding on for dear life, as the grey rocks rush by on either side. And then we're out, and calm returns. We go through 4 more sets of rapids, and each time I'm astounded at my guide's skill and our luck. Eventually, the river widens to a slow meander, and we leave the primary forest, entering a hot landscape of scrubby, tangled trees and abandoned rice fields. We move slowly, poling along the sandy river bottom. Sadly, it's soon time for our farewells. Arun and Atai offer me pantuns, short proverbs.
Today we'll eat the ilipinat. Tomorrow we'll just eat grass. Today we'll all sail together. Tomorrow we'll be gone our own ways.
If there is a spring in the rice field, may I use it to take a wash? if I live to be an old man, I hope we all meet again.
The trip has been a great success. I found an unexpectedly large area of pristine forest, a boon for conservation and perfect to help answer scientific questions. But I wonder, how much will that help Arun, Atai, Freddy and Queen? I fear for their future. Their forest is disappearing all around them.
Our Borneo audio diary was written and produced by Campbell Webb and read by Robin Lovett. And for this week, that's Living on Earth.